have to drop. So hang around for that. Occupy the airwaves on after that, and they'll update you perhaps on the demo. It's past 11. It's time to kick it off. Thanks for listening. Opinions are those of the speakers, not indeed necessarily shared by others at the station. We'll be right back.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the Saturday, March 3rd, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and streamed live worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour program and those of the speaker do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, you can call 217-469-6111. That's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week is entitled Marchers Serving the Dream. Also here with us today, co-host Bob Pelesny, co-host Pat Simpson, and co-host and founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell. And so now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
Demand is beginning to grow for mortgage refinancings under a revamped government program for homeowners with little or no home equity. The Home Affordable Refinance Program, also known as HARP 2.0, is expected to help more than a million borrowers to refinance at current low interest rates, even if falling home values have left them owing more on their loans than the homes are worth. Initial changes to extend HARP's reach were first announced in October, and lenders have in recent months launched their revamped programs. To be eligible, HARP applicants must have loans owned and or guaranteed by Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae and must have less than 20% equity and be current on payments. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo all report they have seen such strong HARP demand they have actually had to add staff. Some Bank of America customers have been put on waiting lists as a result of the enhanced response. One in three refinancing applications now at Wells Fargo are through HARP. Some consumers pursuing traditional refinancing, typically those who have substantial home equity, are seeing their refinancing applications take somewhat longer as lenders deal with the HARP demand. Bob?
Thanks, Tom. 2 million home care workers are finally getting a little respect under U.S. labor law. New Labor Department rules extending overtime and minimum wage protections to home health aides and personal care assistants could go into force later this month. 29 states don't cover such basic wage and hour concerns for home-based workers. Since 1975, workers who provide non-medical assistance in the home have been classified as companions and excluded from federal overtime pay and minimum wage protections, even as an $84 billion home care industry has grown up to profit from their labor. Four-fifths of home care funding comes from public sources. The workforce is 92% female, and around half are black or Latino. There's estimates that about 50,000 home care workers make less than minimum wage, and about a million hover at or just over minimum wage. A tiny fraction are unionized. These rules will go into effect after a comment period, which ends March 12th. And as you would expect, home care employers are up in arms against the new federal rules, claiming dire consequences if they're required to pay overtime premiums and to pay workers as they travel between clients.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it'll cut into their obscene profits.
$84 billion worth
of
profits.
Wow.
Well, not profits, but
revenue anyway.
But, yes.
You figure average 20% return. Yeah, that's still a lot of money.
Just one comment on this. There's some further developments in California, and in future programs we may actually have someone come to phone in to speak to us about a California law that is going to provide some protections for domestic workers. But I also want to point out that I think it was just about 3 years ago that the Human Rights Watch issued a report that took the United States to task for the failure of the National Labor Relations Act and related labor laws to provide adequate coverage to whole groups of workers. And, of course, domestic workers are among them. So.
Yeah, who else falls through the cracks on that besides domestic workers?
Agricultural
workers.
And in fact, workers that operate in small businesses. Many of our laws just essentially apply, and it varies how they define a small business. But in many cases, small businesses do not have any coverage. And this is one of the problems with domestic workers, because they, in fact, are, of course, operating in private homes and arguably, in many cases, can be thought of as essentially operating in places that are not large enough to be covered by any of these laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, they still need to be covered. They're still workers. But anyway, a bill passed Monday in the U.S. Congress and Thursday in the Senate would make it a felony, a serious criminal offense punishable by lengthy terms of incarceration, to participate in many forms of protest associated with the Occupy Wall Street protests of last year. Several commentators have dubbed it the anti-Occupy law, but its implications are far broader. The bill, House Resolution 347, or the Federal Restricted Buildings and Grounds Improvement Act of 2011, where do they come up with these titles, was passed by unanimous consent in the Senate. Even Bernie Sanders, it appears, went along with this crap, while only Ron Paul and two other Republicans voted against the bill in the House of Representatives. The bill passed 388-3. Not a single Democratic politician voted against this bill. Unbelievable. Where was Dennis Kucinich? Anyway, the virtually unanimous passage of House Resolution 347 starkly exposes the fact that despite the posturing, the Democrats and the Republicans stand shoulder to shoulder together with the corporate and financial oligarchy, which regarded last year's popular protests in the Occupy movement against social inequality with a mixture of fear and hostility. Among the central provisions of House Resolution 347 is a section that would make it a criminal offense to enter or remain in an area designated as quote-unquote restricted. The bill defines the areas that qualify as restricted in extremely vague and broad terms. Restricted areas can include a building or grounds where the president or other persons protected by the Secret Service is or will be temporarily visiting, and or a building or grounds so restricted in conjunction with an event designated as a special event of quote-unquote national significance. Okay. What circumstances constitute events of national significance is left to the unbridled discretion of the Department of Homeland Security. The occasion for virtually any large protest could be designated by the Department of Homeland Security as an event of quote-unquote national significance, making any demonstration in the vicinity illegal. For certain, included among such events would be the Democratic and Republican National Conventions, which has been classified as national security, special security events, a category created under the Clinton administration. And these conventions have been the occasion for protests that have been subjected to ever-increasing police restrictions and repression. Under House Resolution 347, future protests at such events could be outright criminalized. The standard punishment of the new law is a fine and up to 1 year in prison. If a weapon or serious physical injury is involved, the penalty may be increased up to 10 years. Also criminalized by the bill is conduct that, quote, impedes or disrupts the orderly conduct of government business or official functions, and obstructs or impedes ingress or egress to or from any restricted building or grounds. These provisions, even more so than the provisions creating the restricted areas, threaten to criminalize a broad range of protest activities that were previously perfectly legal. In order to appreciate the unprecedented sweep of House Resolution 347, it is necessary to consider a few examples. A wide area around the G20 meeting coming up in Chicago or other global summits could be designated restricted by the Secret Service, such that any person who just merely enters that area can be subjected to a fine and a year in jail. And you know, if a felony to enter any restricted building or grounds without lawful authority to do so. Senator Rick Santorum, Republican presidential candidate, enjoys the protection of the Secret Service. Accordingly, a person who shouts boo during a speech by Santorum could be subjected to arrest and a year imprisonment under Section 1752 of this bill, making it a felony to engage in disorderly or disruptive conduct in a restricted area. Folks, I'm telling you, we're moving fast into a police state, and we better start defying these laws. I think it's going to have to come to where people are going to have to be mass. They're going to have to be mass arrests. We're going to have to fill the jails like the Wobblies did in the early part of this century, and like with the civil rights demonstrators in the 60s. I'm telling you, the police state is here, and it's growing. I'm sorry to say, but we better. This should be a wake up call to all of us. And our Democrats are not our friends.
According to the U of I's Institute of Government and Public Affairs, the University of Illinois Flash Index increased to its highest point in more than 3 years, reaching 99.2 in February. The index is a weighted average of growth rates in corporate earnings, consumer spending, and personal income as measured by state tax receipts. The Flash Index dipped to 90 in August of 2009 and has generally been climbing since then. The last time the index was this high was in November of 2008 when it stood at 100. The following month, it dropped to 98.7. The last 6 months have been a period of ups and downs, with the index reaching 98.8 last September, then falling back, then climbing to 99.1 in December, then dropping to 98.8 in January before hitting 99.2 last month. However, in spite of the brief rush of promise, the recovery remains relatively weak, especially in regard to unemployment rates, which, according to U of I economist J. Fred Gertz, are likely to keep the recovery slow in the coming year. Bob?
Thanks, Tom. Employees at Cooper Tire and Rubber Company will be returning to work soon, now that the company and the United Steelworkers Union have reached a new agreement. The company and United Steelworkers Union Local 207L ratified a new 5-year labor agreement Monday afternoon. This agreement, which affects about 1,050 union members, ends a 3-month lockout that began November 28th at the company's Findlay, Ohio plant, a day after union members voted down a tentative 3-year agreement. Union members voted 627 to 321 in favor of the latest agreement. In a written statement, the company said it was pleased with the new agreement, and union officials were also glad the work stoppage is ending. However, not everything's been settled. The United Steelworkers filed unfair labor practice charges against Cooper with Region 8 of the National Labor Relations Board shortly after the lockout began that, if upheld, may trigger a back pay liability for the time the NLRB determines the lockout was illegal. Breaking federal laws, importing a temporary replacement workforce, and demanding unfair and unreasonable wage and benefit cuts instead of negotiating in good faith are not the actions of a responsible corporate citizen, said United Steelworkers District 1 Director Dave McCall. We look forward to an answer from the NLRB on these charges. Cooper will not escape accountability for its actions. And as Mike Elk pointed out in another article this week about this agreement, he says not all the workers were happy. There's a 2-tier contract now calling for caps at 85% of the pay that people made before 2009. They're also changing from a benefit pension plan to a 401k instead. So
That's never good because the company can raid a 401k and basically rob it legally. Okay, this is from Chicago. In a reversal of fortunes for Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel's bullying and union-busting tactics have not only been uncovered but challenged by state officials on the Chicago Facilities Task Force. What was established by evidence and eyewitnesses' testimony in a hearing on January 12th is that Rahm Emanuel's push to turn over public schools to private corporations in his use of textbook union-busting schemes to get what he wants. The most disturbing revelations about Mayor 1% was the use of paid outside agitators to speak in favor of closing public schools and board officials forging documents to push out homeless students from one school. State Representative Esther Golar said she was at the meeting about Reed School in Englewood, which is set to receive Guggenheim students, and saw people arrive on a bus. She said she talked to them and discovered they were from a halfway house and were paid $25 to come to the meeting and protest. Two busloads of rent-a-protesters at the Diet High School closing hearing on January 6th became confused when challenged about their signs and attitude, and by the end of the hearing, many had taken down their signs and agreed with those who opposed the Board of Education's attack on diet. The signs held up by the Renna protesters were the same at all seven hearings across Chicago on January 6th. One of those who sat with Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel at the August 25th, 2011 preacher patronage breakfast at Sox Parks was Reverend Roosevelt Watkins, who later was a prime organizer of the Renna protest groups that picketed the Chicago Board of Education, City Council, and the Chicago Teachers Union during 2011 and in January 2012. The brief sermon delivered by Reverend Roosevelt Watkins at the August 25th preacher breakfast at Sox Park was urging those present to sign the petition supporting the longer school day that Mayor Emanuel was using as a wedge issue against the Chicago Teachers Union, and to preach from their pulpits on Sunday in support of the mayor's attack on the Chicago Teachers Union. The Christian breakfast took place one day after many of the same ministers and churches staged a loud demonstration outside the headquarters of Chicago Public Schools. On August 24th, the day of the Board of Education meeting, ministers held a press conference demanding the longer school day and longer school year while their supporters held up printed signs. 80 students at Guggenheim School had transfer notices delivered to their home over Christmas break. Guggenheim teacher Kimberly Walls said none of these children or parents asked to be transferred to another school and were called several times by school staff insisting they take the transfer. Transfer papers were then slipped under their doors or taped on their doors.
Really interesting. This whole push for privatization of the public schools in Chicago at the head of, being pushed by Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Representative Martinez she said it was incredible these principals took these steps while the school closing was just a proposal. In the meantime, the principal was transferring students. It's amazing. There was a Good Democracy Now! Segment on this week, Wednesday, where they interviewed Karen Lewis, the rank-and-file elected current teachers union president. And she said in a personal meeting with Rahm Emanuel last week, he said to her that there's 100,000 students in the city schools in Chicago that'll never amount to anything, and that he's just writing them off and they don't want to spend any more money than they have to on them. And that privatizing the schools is the only solution. Now, for a lot of you who don't realize that the Chicago Board of Education is not an elected body like it is in most towns and municipalities. It's appointed with corporate hacks by the mayor. So anyway, we'll keep you posted on that. That story came from Larry Duncan in Chicago from the Labor Beat video production.
Oh, yeah, Dave. In Illinois, I don't know how it is in many other areas, but Chicago is pretty unique in that the city operates the schools rather than a separate school district.
Yes, yes. And that was, I guess, done by some law that was passed in the Illinois legislature back sometime in the 70s or 80s. But very undemocratic. And, of course, with the school board's, got all these appointments with all these corporate hacks, including the woman who's the part owner of the Hyatt Regency Hotel. I mean, of course, they're pushing the corporate agenda, which is, privatize, privatize, privatize. Basically using public funds to guarantee private corporations a profit at the expense of our students.
What I also find interesting in Emanuel's comments is the fact that he basically is writing off students who are difficult to reach, which ironically are precisely the kinds of students that they usually use as a rationale for why privatization is necessary.
Exactly.
I mean, so
exactly.
It's the contradiction, the embedded contradiction there is just phenomenal. And he's showing the true colors is basically what's his true colors on many different fronts.
Indeed.
He was called, what, Mayor 1%?
Yeah, Mayor 1%. Yeah. You know, it's amazing. When he was running for the mayor of Chicago, I was working at a local school here, and there was a lot of people that worked there that were from Chicago originally, and they thought he was great. Just why? When I questioned him, why they thought, because he's a friend of Barack Obama's.
Well, besides
that, makes
that
him
okay.
Dave,
that's like almost every Teamster you'll talk to around here will tell you that he's going to vote for Jimmy Hoffa whenever there's a Teamsters election, just because.
Of his father.
And the name recognition and on and on. Rahm Emanuel, he's worked in two White Houses. And the people are identifying with him. Oh, I'm from Chicago too,
I know, I tell you, it's, It's frustrating, you know. Sometimes we're our own worst enemy. But anyway, a little music here, and we're going to go then to Tom Thomas's poem of the week, and then we're going to be having a caller calling a carpenter from the Carpenters Union in Albany, New York, talking about some interesting things going on in the National Carpenters Union. So stay tuned. Now come to that portion of the Illinois World Labor Hour, the Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas's brand new poem of the week, Marchers Serving the Dream.
Many hundreds of years ago, people who were different burned at some psychotic judge's stakes, with righteousness totally spurned. Times of immature innocence, ignorance, should have ended so long ago, but innocents still burn at stakes when they dare to dream they can grow. Nowadays it's just a metaphor, but everybody seems to know having to be burned at the stake has to be the lowest of low. When measuring percentages, none of the royal 1% seems smart enough to figure out what good is gold that isn't spent. They need to spread that wealth around, creating gainful employment, feeding the hungriest, poorest who simply cannot pay their rent. We don't burn we workers at the stake because we march across our land, because your fires will be quenched by we who choose to take a stand. When justice comes to serve the dream, the hungry will know concession, because enough of us stood up to march against a depression. Marchers Serving the Dream was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on February 29, 2012, and was brought to you live today, May 3, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I think we got our caller calling in now. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Mr. Johnson. My name is Richard Doro. I'm calling you from upstate New York.
Okay, Richard, thanks for calling in. Do you want to give us just a little background on yourself?
Yes, certainly. I'm an expelled member of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters. Was in their union for 24 years. Got tired of McCarran's new corporate unionism and his, you know, his treatment of the members. And, you know, we started, I'm the founder of Carpenters Independent Local 1 here in Albany, New York. We decided to break away from the UBC. And join other groups around New York State that are doing the same thing. I maintain a website called Local 370 Voice, which provided documents to members that the UBC refused to supply. And, of course, there's a little colorful commentary on the UBC officers as well. But
okay.
And McCarran's policies in general. So we, you know, fought, went the route and went to the ERISA, Department of Labor, the NLRB, and had no success. So in August of 2011, we founded Carpenters Independent Local 1 and broke away from the UBC.
Okay, and that was in Albany, or?
In Albany, New York, yeah.
Okay, all right. Now, the reason I wanted you to call in, because last week there was several emails that went out talking about a carpenters union, evidently yours in Albany, as well as one in Buffalo, New York, and also the dock workers of New York City, too, that were talking about disaffiliation. And being a 32 member of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters up until 2009, and also very, very active in the resistance for the Democratic rank and file movement within the Carpenters Union, pretty much our big war from 98 to 2002 and beyond, that I was thrilled to see this. But then it started, some more information came out that there's a little bit more complexity to this and everything. And that's kind of, you know, of course, why I wanted you to call in to kind of explain kind of what's happened now. That's kind of, it's not so cut and dried. So could you kind of go into sort of a little of the history on this?
Well, what happened to us is that, you know, we were seized on any help that we could get. We fought by ourselves for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Then Trump announced the Resolution 70 initiative, and we saw great hope in that, and we started contacting him right away, asking for his assistance.
And what was that Resolution 70 exactly?
Resolution 70 was passed by the AFL-CIO that if the UBC continued to refuse to come back into the AFL-CIO, that the AFL-CIO would start to charter carpenters unions. And we naturally assumed that we're told that you know, they would be direct charters with the AFL-CIO. We were told that for a while. So we finally got response, and the response came from Jim Williams, the president of the Tapers and Painters, the IUPAT.
Mm-hmm.
They finally met with us. We met with Dwayne Moore, who has a website called Respect Our Crafts, which is built and maintained, I guess, by the building trades. And, you know, basically has what it worked out is that, you know, they were going to require an international to sponsor any group that decided to leave the UBC, such as ourselves, such as a group in Buffalo called the Carpenters for Concerned Carpenters for Democracy, and the amalgamated group in New York City, who now we're not really sure who they are, but
okay.
They have a group that decided to break away as well. So we got our sponsor, and that sponsor came to us, and it was the IUPAT. We dealt with Jim Williams Sr., and then Jim Williams Jr. was our direct contact. And we made it clear from the beginning that we were not going to leave the UBC and get away from corporate unionism and McCarran's tyrannical reign to put ourselves under, you know, the reign of another international. So we made it clear we would not affiliate. And they told us over and over, and you can see YouTube videos of Mr. Williams making these statements, that there's no obligation, that they do not want us to affiliate, and that everything they're doing is for democracy and independence and because of what McCarran is doing and how it will affect labor as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So we proceeded.
Okay. Just a little background for listeners who aren't familiar. Back in 2001, early 2001, Doug McCarran, the president of the Carpenters Union, withdrew from the National AFL-CIO and the National Building Trades without any vote from the rank-and-file membership. The vast majority of the rank-and-file membership of the Carpenters Union was opposed to this. And he immediately started a policy of basically wanting to raid the other building trades for their work, and that he basically was going to create new locals, basically recruit from non-union tradesmen, put them into a separate local, let's say painters or electricians even, set them up in a local which they would have wages and benefits below the unionized tradesmen, and then go and raid their work. I had to throw that in there just to give a little background for those who aren't familiar with the story going back several years. So anyway, Richard, please continue.
Yes, and that's absolutely true. And just to throw a quick commentary on that, you know, the McCarran didn't leave, as he said, because the AFL-CIO were, you know, not spending the money correctly, organizing correctly, or waiting for the UBC's money.
Mm-hmm.
He left just for that reason, for raiding. There is a bylaw the AFL-CIO, I think it's 19 or 20, Article 19 or 20, that prevents them from raiding each other's work. And he immediately went and formed a Tapers local in New York City. There was already existing Local 1174, I think it was. He started recruiting tapers and painters. He actually started teaching that in our apprentice schools. They went out and bought bazookas and all the tapers and painters' tools. He took it to a representation vote, and he lost big time. I mean, not even 2%. So that's exactly what he was up to. The shame of it is that, and this is what I'm worried about and how it's going to affect the rest of organized labor, is I think the other internationals now are taking that cue and making that attempt themselves.
Yes, it seems like a rotten bad apple just, you know, spreads like a virus, you know, unfortunately.
Well, just to give you background on what we did is that there was a group before us in New Jersey called New Jersey Carpenters United, They got started. They had a Tabors and Painters paid for attorney named Warren Borish. They were holding meetings and they were moving forward. Then the Tabors and Painters went to them and demanded affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
That they had to affiliate with the Tabors and Painters International. When they refused to do that, they pulled the plug on them.
Okay.
Pulled back the lawyers, pulled back all their help. Now, so we were the second in line, and they came up to us, and we started moving forward. We got an office, you know, the phone's all hooked up, and, you know, got our address and things going. And as we got up to our second day of authorization cards, which was great. I mean, the first day we got 150 signed, and, you know, we were moving forward great. All of a sudden, they hit us too.
Okay.
But that's when we produced the documents to hand out to our members saying that we either had to affiliate with the Tabors and Painters, and they were pulling the plug. And when we refused by a vote of our committee, they tried to take over Local One, and they were going to move forward with no carpenters in Albany. Well, they you know, were unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
So what did they next do is they moved down to New York City and started working with the Amalgamated Group. That's where they are now. And that was in August of 2011, that group was actually created, not by the dock builders, but by an attorney in New York City by the name of Angelo Biscelli. he signed with the Tabors and Painters. He had an affiliation agreement that there wasn't a single dock builder present when they signed it.
Mm-hmm.
He sat down with Williams Sr., Williams Jr., Joe Kolick, Richard Furlong, and himself, and they came to this agreement.
Okay.
There wasn't a rank and file member present.
Now, the dock workers used to be a separate specialty local within the United Brotherhoods, and McCarran dissolved them and robbed their treasury back a few years ago. Is that correct?
That is correct. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to go back a bit, that was the last straw on why we decided to break away, is McCarran came through upstate New York, dissolved all the locals, merged them all into 10, robbed all the accounts of each individual local. Supposedly that money went to the they forced us into the Northeast Regional Council out of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
They also dissolved the Empire Council, and there was I believe White Plains, New York, and that was all put into New Jersey as well.
Mm-hmm.
We had $850,000 in our bank account. They took it all, gave us back $50,000 about 2 months later, and said at our meeting that you can use this to have clam bakes and to make charitable donations. You're not to use it for anything else because we're going to run your local completely.
They
pulled our charter. And they merged us into Local 291.
Okay.
No vote of the rank and file. The members were not included in any of it. And that's what they've done to us. So that was the last straw for us as well.
Well, sure. I mean, this is not just corporate unionism. This is feudalism. I mean, it really is.
It really is. And it's a shame that when I say that we went through ERISA, we went through the Department of Labor, we went through the NLRB. I mean, we had an ERISA investigation going on into the funds of the Empire Council. While that was going on, they lost $160 million to MATA. They fired all the trustees for allegations of corruption and defraud in the membership. But yet, we got a call from ERISA saying they were ending the investigation, and they found nothing wrong. Then we find out that their lead advisory counsel is Robert Archer, the union's lawyer. So we could never get anywhere. This is why we made a decision, finally, to go on our own. You can't. He circled the wagon so much, you can't get to him, McCarran, and you can't defeat him. You know, and there's no chance of democracy or anything in the UBC anymore. So that's why we decided to go.
Now, I've seen postings on your website over the years, and we've got a mutual carpenter friend out your way and stuff, it seems like you guys' experience over the years when you've tried to go, like you went to the local Department of Labor, NLRB, it seems like those people that work there that are the field investigators and the higher-ups have a real cozy relationship with the carpenter union officials.
Absolutely. Every single case that we've filed with the NLRB Region 3 office, they've turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
We actually are automatically ready to appeal to Washington just to get them to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
Then we find out that they made donations to retirement parties and retirements of Local 370 carpenters.
Okay, officials.
Same thing
stuff.
With the Empire Council attorney, Robert Archer. He's the advisory counsel for ERISA. And the lawyer out of his office that was fighting our investigation for the Empire Council, after our investigation was dropped, he's now on the advisory council for ERISA. So, I mean, they stacked the deck against you that they none of them want to do their jobs. You have to force them, and then you don't stand a chance.
Okay.
They work for each other.
Yes. It definitely seems to be the case. So what are you guys doing now? I mean, what's your next move?
Well, what happened to us is that when we refused to affiliate, the Tabors and Painters pulled the plug on us because – what's happened here is they've hijacked the Resolution 70 initiative.
Mm-hmm.
They are deciding for the FLCIO and Trumka who gets aid and who doesn't get aid. We had our charter approved on October 12, 2011. Then they hit us with the affiliation a week later. You know, here they had written a write-up for us to get the charter saying how we're the greatest thing in the world and viable and, you know, we were going to go move forward. When we refused to affiliate, they turned around and went back 2 weeks later, told them we had gone off the deep end, had internal problems, and we could no longer be helped or supported. So they pulled everything, and the FLCIO won't even respond to us. So they've hijacked the Resolution 70 process, and they're controlling the whole thing.
Okay.
You don't affiliate with the Tabers and Painters or another international trade, you don't get any help or financing.
Okay.
Now, the problem with that is this, what's going on is this is an attempt for, you know, to help with democracy and independence. It's an attempt to break the Carpenters.
Mm-hmm.
Any group that wants to break away are going to be forced to affiliate with another international, and it's their intention of keeping them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we find that McCarran and the UBC filed a RICO case on February 22nd, and they're suing everybody. In that case, there's an Exhibit 7 written by the Laborers International, and in it, it states that for their future business strategy, for their survival, that there are disgruntled carpenters in the UBC who are sick of the UBC, are seeking an alternative. So therefore, the other trades who are doing it have advised them that they should do it as well, and they're going to create carpenters locals within the Laborers International and divisions of carpenters locals in Laborers International.
Mm-hmm.
And they're keeping them.
Okay.
And that's exactly what they're doing. They're coming after these people, promising them that the independence and democracy, saying that they're only helping for that reason, when the fact of the matter is, they're going to break the carpenters. They're looking for carpenters locals within their organizations to keep to supplement their accounts and supplement their union.
Okay.
And basically, this is the IUPAT using Resolution 70 to wage a war against the carpenters.
Okay.
And settle a vendetta.
Okay. Bill?
Hi. My name is Bill Grell, and I'm a laborer. And I definitely have to admit that there is no way that we could cover carpenter work.
Well, but if they recruit actual carpenter tradesmen into...
That's their intention.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but it would be, you know, it'd take a while and it'd be difficult.
Yeah.
Well, in all honesty, no, it wouldn't be, because if they go ahead and get these groups, they have a representation election, and they name, just like they're doing now, the amalgamated group in New York City aren't voting for amalgamated to be their bargaining agent. They're voting for a new group called the Amalgamated Carpenters and Joiners, who are direct affiliated with the IUPAT. In Buffalo, they're not voting for the Concerned Carpenters for Democracy to be their bargaining agent. They're voting for the sheet metal workers to be their bargaining agent. So what happens is, immediately, the sheet metal workers or the laborers or the IUPAT have a whole pool of experienced carpenters.
Okay.
And the contractors to go with them. That's the way it works.
Okay.
It's not going to take any time.
Mm-hmm. Just to give a little background on McCarran, you know, I got a few quotes here. Basically, speaking at the National Rectors Association Convention in 2000, Doug McCarran said, quote, you need the freedom, talking about the contractors, you need the freedom to assign the work based on what makes sense, what makes us all competitive on the job. If there's a dispute, let the owner settle it. It's his money and his job. In other words, McCarran's view that the union is a little more than an employment agency, which is linked at the hip to the contractors, and that's why many of us get, the carpenters get such poor contracts and poor enforcement. And also, I was going to ask you, are you familiar with an individual named Mark Breslin?
I know the last name Breslin, but only as a political candidate in New York State.
Okay.
I don't know if he's related or not.
Okay, he's a close advisor and associate of McCarran, and it's interesting because in the August 2003 issue of the Carpenters magazine, they described Breslin as, quote, he's a self-professed management SOB who represent employers in sticky issues such as lockout strikes, jurisdictional disputes, and the like. Breslin is also well-respected in union circles for his hard-hitting business savvy. And Breslin was, speaking at some United Brotherhood of Carpenters function, giving advice to union officials, and it's just interesting. I mean, how this corporate unionism that I think Doug McCarran is pretty much the epitome of is such a, you know, a detriment to individual union members and tradesmen.
To further prove that, part of our new contract and one of the sticking points in New York City, they're trying to go, or you know, sign their contract now is what's called 100% mobility.
Okay.
They came to us and told us that any carpenters or any, with the new contract, any contractor can come into New York State in our area,
mm-hmm.
bring their entire crew,
mm-hmm.
and not have to hire a single local carpenter.
You know, that goes directly in the face of why prevailing wage laws were passed back in the 30s, starting with the LaGuardia Act in New York City, basically because of the abuse of Southern contractors coming into New York City, bringing their crews with them, putting them up in shanty towns, paying them poverty wages, and then leaving the state, the city and the state with all that money in their pockets, which did nothing for the very little for the local economy, you know. And
we have one of the largest jobs in the Northeast called Global Foundries Project.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be hard pressed to go into that parking lot and find a New York State plate.
Mm-hmm.
They took $3 billion in New York State tax money, promising jobs for local workers and local New York taxpayers, and they're bringing them in. But the unions are doing it, bringing them in from all over except for New York State.
Mm-hmm.
I had a meeting with M.W. Zander over this issue and asked them how they could possibly take $3 billion and not be hiring local workers.
Mm-hmm.
They said they had a verbal agreement with the union. It wasn't in the PLA, but they would hire, you know, the local union people first.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Garrison of the UBC actually went and met with them and told them it was going to get even worse. If they didn't like it, it was too bad. It was going to get even worse because now they're coming up with the 100% mobility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they did. All it's right. not the non-union that they're bringing in people from out of state. Mm-hmm. It's the union.
Yeah. That's
now, how can you go into a community and attend their meetings and say you should build union, but we're not going to hire anybody who lives in your community because that's what they're doing.
That's amazing.
Now, part of that is to appeal to the appease the contractors, but part of it up here is you're going to see that the UBC, because they're being threatened with people breaking away, are switching from 8F to 9A contracts.
Which
9A
are,
contracts mm-hmm. are much more restrictive,
mm-hmm.
and part of giving the contractors 100% mobility, in my opinion, is an exchange for the 9A designation, because you can't get 9A unless you, one, have prove a majority representation of the members by a vote of the MLRB
mm-hmm.
or voluntary recognition.
Okay.
In New York City and all the contracts, that's exactly what they've done. They're changing to 9A. The contractors are giving them voluntary recognition. So what did they give in return?
Okay. All right. Well, Richard, listen, thank you for so much for calling in, and let's definitely keep in touch here. And as things you know, develop here, I'd like to have you call in again sometime in the future and give us an update and stuff, because I think, you know, this is an issue that's not just going to affect people in the building trades, but, you know, this is going to spread to other professions and, you know, industries and stuff. And I think, you know, we really need to be aware of this creeping cancer, if you will.
Well, and the biggest, you know, before I leave you, and I thank you for having me, somebody needs to really take a close look at this RICO case that McCarran has filed, because he sued everybody. And I got the worry that, you know, wonder that if organized labor is going to survive it. This is a big war. I mean, he sued, you know, Ayers and the building trades and right down to their legal counsel, and it's just amazing. And we're included in that as a non-participatory defendant or participating defendant. But the lies that they put in there about us are so blatant
it's,
that I'm shocked that a lawyer would actually risk submitting them to a court.
It's really
this battle is huge.
It's ironic that someone like McCarran files a RICO suit. I mean, it's
yeah, I know.
You know.
He actually made a statement in there that the other internationals think they could take his carpenter members as if they were chattel. Well, what do you think he treats us like?
Oh, indeed, indeed. Richard, thanks so much for calling
right.
in, and we'll be in touch. Take care.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
I just wanted to make one comment on that. Generally speaking, we tend to think of voluntary recognition as a good thing, you know, something that occurs partly mm-hmm. because there's a recognition by employers that the union is strong enough and they might as well throw in the towel, as it's more trouble not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Here we see a situation where voluntary recognition can become the basis of a quid pro quo between corporate unionists, corporate union bureaucrats, and management, and basically is a way of undermining workers' interests.
Oh, indeed, indeed. I got a real quick public service announcement here that I was unable to get in earlier. It's basically Flexengate workers are having a speak out at 1 p.m. next Saturday, March 10th, at Channing Murray Foundation, which is the corner of Oregon and Matthews, and in Urbana, and I wanted to make sure that everybody knew, especially anyone making plans for the location. But anyway, that again is a rally. That's going to be following that on March 13th at in front of the Flexing Gate headquarters at 1306 University. But the main thing is to get out next Saturday at 1 p.m. at Channing Murray. That's Saturday, March 10th, corner of Oregon and Matthews, to hear the Flexing Gate workers themselves speak out about what they've been enduring and everything. So anyway, Bill, you said you had something you wanted to play for us.
Would like to do in honor of a man who just died this week. And I'm not talking about Davy Jones of the Monkees. Who, by the way, very strangely, several years ago, he played at the Monticello Middle School.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was after we got done building it a few months after it opened. They had a concert with Davy Jones there. And he didn't play anywhere else that I know of, anywhere in this area. Wow. But he played at the Monticello Middle School.
What an honor.
But hey, well, Andrew Breitbart died, and
Who was Andrew Breitbart?
He was a sort of an right-wing internet entrepreneur, maven, monger person who is also sort of a mentor to, and I can't remember those two young guys' names who did Acorn In with their videos, and who later went on to get arrested for messing with that senator from Louisiana's telephones. Right. And so on and so forth. And he was widely despised by people any farther left than
Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, Mitt Romney or something. And he just died this week. And I would strongly suggest that you look up Matt Taibbi's column on this.
The Rolling Stones journalist. Yeah, he's written some good stuff. Yeah.
But this is a video that came out, I believe it was a few weeks ago, and it was after Andrew Breitbart spoke at CPAC. And if you haven't seen it, he's got this long, wild, gray-looking hair and this big gray beard. He's a really large man in a trench coat, and he's out screaming at the Occupy protesters who are protesting Occupy. And we'll follow that with a song by the Sick Puppies.
Okay, ready?
Yes.
You're freaks and animals. Behave yourself. Behave yourself. Behave.
Racist, sexist, anti-gay, right-wing bigots, go away. 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 Racist, sexist, anti-gay, right-wing bigots, go away.
This is War by the Sick Puppies.
We'll be right back.
Okay, that was the Sick Puppies, and what was the title of that song? War?
War.
Okay, and why did you play that, Bill?
I don't know. I just came across it, and they had the lyrics, and it looked like it was pretty good. This is War, and it's on tonight, so get up and fight, get up and fight. You know.
You said this annoys, for some reason, this band has really annoyed a lot of right-wingers in the past for some reason.
Well, Bob was just saying that it's on the soundtracks of a lot of documentaries. Like, I don't know if Loose Change would be right-wing or left-wing.
It's neither.
A conspiracy, but I've seen it on the internet, right-wing people really bitching about this band.
Yeah, but, okay, well, that's that was quite interesting that, you know, it's that, what's his last name again, Andrew?
Andrew Breitbart. Some people think he had a little bit too much to drink there at the conference when he came out, but he was just losing his mind, and he just died, what was it, 2 days ago?
Okay.
And interestingly enough, for those of you old people like me who remember game shows from our childhood, you might remember Orson Bean being on those shows, and he was Andrew Breitbart's father-in-law.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
Yes, small world.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Okay, real quick, with the time we've got left here, you know, I wanted to just do a quick segment on a very famous and influential African-American labor leader that most people have never heard of. His name's Ben Fletcher, and he was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, the Philadelphia dock workers. And this guy, I mean, you know, he's buried in history. I mean, most people, when they hear of African-American labor leaders, the only one they can name is A. Philip Randolph. And by the way, who's also a great labor leader who we've talked about here on the show in the past. And there's a really good actual dramatization of his organizing efforts.
10,000 men named George.
10,000 black men named George, done by Mario Van Peebles, of all people.
You know, and I wouldn't be surprised if you could find it at the local public libraries, too. You might take a check.
Yes, yes. But indeed, here about Ben Fletcher, he was born in 1890, and he was anyway, one of the most important African Americans, labor leaders, and one of the most influential radical unions of the time, the early 20th century, which was the Industrial Workers of the World. And he became active in the IWW while working as a longshoreman, loading and loading cargo ships in Philadelphia, and joined the union in 1912. And he quickly became a very popular leader and speaker, and he proved you know, to be one of the most prominent leaders of Local 8. There was many, but he had a real talent to basically be able to overcome all the racial and ethnic divisions that the employers encouraged, you know, divide the workers. In Local 8, there were thousands of African-Americans and West Indians, and also as well as thousands of Irish Americans and thousands of Eastern European immigrants, which the employers played off against each other with segregated work groups, given some privileges and others not. Some of the worst dangerous jobs. Sounds familiar, like Flexengate here and today in Urbana. But anyway, this was back in the 19-teens. So anyway, during World War I, Fletcher and other IWW leaders were targeted by the federal government because of the union's anti-war stance. Though Local 8 called no strikes during the war, the government nevertheless feared its power and more generally the influence of the IWW. And with a combination of the federal government, the police, and establishment of Philadelphia, the dock worker owners, the dock, basically the ship owners, as well as a corrupt mob-influenced union, the ILA, they were able to destroy Local 8, the IWW Local 8, and Fletcher was the sole African-American among over 100 IWW members tried and convicted in 1918 for treason. Though no evidence was ever brought against him or the others specifically, Fletcher was sentenced to 10 years in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary and fined $30,000, which would be equivalent to about $500,000 today. Fletcher served 3 years, and then his sentence was commuted in 1922 after 3 years. But anyway, after his release, Fletcher became celebrated among black radicals and championed by the Messenger newspaper, which was co-edited by A. Philip Randolph and Chandler Owen. And afterwards, Fletcher remained committed to his IWW ideals, though never played an active role in the union leadership again. And then he died in Brooklyn in 1949. But anyway, what was really fascinating about this local, besides overcoming these racial and ethnic divisions, was that they set the standards for conditions on the whole East Coast. This is one local of 5,000 members through various strikes. And if there was ever any kind of problem on the job site, basically they would shut a job down at a drop of a hat, if necessary. You know, this guy, I mean, he is incredible. And it's amazing how he's his whole existence is buried in history. And we did have there was a great book called Wobblies on the Waterfront, written by Professor Peter Cole, who we actually had on the Illinois World Labor Hour about 2-3 years ago, who lives over in Macomb, Illinois.
Oh, really? Yeah, that would be where Western is. Is he associated with the university?
Yes, indeed. In fact, he's a friend of Jim Barrett's. In fact, speaking of which.
Well, actually, he might also be acquainted with Rose Foyer.
Probably.
At Western, St. Louis Labor Vision veteran.
Yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And speaking of Jim Barrett, if you're listening out there, Jim, we definitely want to get you on the show here coming up because there's a lot of fascinating stuff coming up